Look, Colonel, I was just an aide, okay? Colonel Nikolai Grishinov was sorry that a man had to go through this, but Colonel Zacharias wasn't a man. He was the enemy, the Russian reminded himself, and he wanted to get the man talking again. It was their sixth session. Grishinov was the only Soviet officer allowed to interview these Americans. The Vietnamese were playing their cards so carefully. 20 prisoners, all the same, all different. Zacharias was as much intelligence officer as fighter pilot, his dossier said. The information had come to the Soviets via American sympathizers within Washington, and it was proving vital in their plans. Grishinov could not bring himself to hate this man, a fighter pilot himself, having just completed a regimental command in PVO Strani, the Soviet Air Defense Command. The Russian was, in a curious way, Zacharias' exact counterpart. Not a KGB officer, certainly not one of these little brown savages. He took no pleasure at all in hurting people, but he could both extract information and analyze it. Grishinov didn't like what he saw now. Zacharias was a skillful and courageous man. His was one of the most complex aspects of national defense. The way they thought, their tactical doctrine, was as important as their plans. And as far as he was concerned, the Americans could kill all these little bastards they wanted. While physical abuse had only hardened this man's resolve, he saw, every man had strengths and weaknesses. He just had to find where they lay. "Tell me," he began easily, "what sort of place is Berkeley?"
"Just a school," Zacharias replied before catching himself. He wasn't supposed to talk. But, dear God, he was tired and scared and sick of living up to a code of conduct that didn't count for beans to anyone else. Grishinov read the man's face. Too soon, he told himself. He'd pushed a little too soon. This one had courage, enough to resist for a long time. But Grishinov had plenty of time.
63 VW, low mileage, radio, heater, 652-1265. Kelly dropped a dime in the payphone and called the number. A few hours later, he was the owner of a slightly rust-eaten VW, nondescript enough to serve his purposes. The next step was renting an apartment in the Baltimore area. That was done with a minimum of effort, and Kelly now had an in-city base of operations. 20 minutes later, Kelly was in a cab heading to the bay, and before long was guiding Springer down the Potomac. Back at the bunker, Kelly packed clothing, his .45 automatic, plus a kit to convert the gun to a .22, and two boxes of ammunition. He fabricated a silencer for the gun, using the bunker's leftover machining tools, then turned to finish his preparations. What had he forgotten? He could think of nothing, but realized he still knew little. Billy with his red Plymouth, a black guy named Henry, he knew their area of operation, and that was all. But he'd fought armed and trained enemies with less knowledge than that, and deep down, he knew he'd accomplish this mission. Partly, he realized, if it was because he didn't care about the consequences, only the results.
"I'm impressed, John," Rosen said, staring at his patient. Kelly sat on the examining table, his shirt off. "How are you otherwise?"
The reply was just a look, neither a smile nor a grimace, just a neutral expression that told Rosen all he needed to know.
"There's an old saying," the doctor said, "before setting out on revenge, dig two graves."
"Only two?" Kelly asked lightly. Rosen nodded.
"I read the post-mortem report, too."
"I can't talk you out of it?"
"How's Sarah?" Rosen accepted the deflection. "Deep into her project. It's pretty interesting stuff."
Just then Sandy O'Toole came in. "You're looking healthy for a guy who just got shot a few weeks ago."
"Clean living, ma'am." "Well, John, you're fine. I've got a conference to go to." Rosen smiled and left the room.
"Where do you get lunch around here?" Kelly asked Sandy.
"You want to risk hospital food?"
"You're the tour guide."
She led him to the cafeteria where they selected something filling, if bland.
Have you been keeping busy? He asked after they selected a table.
Always, she assured him.
Where do you live?
Off Lochraven Boulevard, she replied.
She hadn't changed, Kelly saw. Sandy O'Toole was functioning quite well, in fact. But the emptiness in her life wasn't qualitatively different from his.
You were very kind to me while I was upstairs.
Thanks.
We try to take care of our patients, she said, with a smile.
A face as pretty as yours should do that more, Kelly told her.
It's hard, she said, serious again.
It's Tim, isn't it? He asked, jolting her. People weren't supposed to talk about that, were they? She stared into Kelly's eyes for a few seconds.
I just don't understand.
The hard part, Kelly said, is understanding why people do things like that. But there are bad people out there, and somebody has to deal with them. Because if you don't, then someday they'll deal with you.
I'll never understand why Tim had to die.
You do some pretty hard work, right?
Yes, Sandy said.
Why not do something easier?
Somebody has to.
Bingo, Kelly thought. It's hard. It hurts you some, right?
Sometimes.
But you do it anyway, Kelly pointed out.
Yes, Sandy said.
That's why Tim did what he did. He saw the understanding there before her lingering grief returned. Maybe we're all trying to save the world, Sandy, one little bit at a time. He rose and insisted on walking her back to the unit. It took the whole 5 minutes to say what he wanted to say. You know, I'd like to have dinner with you, maybe. Not now, but, well,
I'll think about it, she allowed,
knowing, as Kelly did, that it was too soon for both of them. What sort of man was this? She asked herself. What were the dangers of knowing him?